top story, the British military says an Israeli-owned ship has come under attack off the coast of Oman. The U.S. says its security commitments in the Philippines extend to the South China Sea as the two countries restore a key troop pact. And Japan expands a coronavirus state of emergency to more areas and extends one already imposed in Tokyo that hosts the Olympic. Welcome to the program. The UK military says an Israeli-owned ship has come under attack off the coast of Oman in the Arabian Sea. According to the British military, the vessel was targeted near Masira Island late on Thursday. It says the attack was not an act of piracy and an investigation is now underway. Israeli company that owns the ship says it was traveling from Tanzania's Dar es Salaam to Fujairah, a port of the UAE. The company said there was no cargo on board the ship at the time of the incident. Israeli and Omani officials have not yet commented on the issue. In recent months, several other Israeli ships have also been targeted in various maritime routes across the world. The Philippines has fully restored a key military deal with the United States amid growing tensions in the contested South China Sea. Defense Secretary Delphine Lorenzana announced the decision during a news conference with his American counterpart in Manila. Lorenzana said President Rodrigo Duterte has retracted his earlier decision to terminate the pact. That's known as the Visiting Forces Agreement. It provides rules for the rotation of thousands of U.S. troops in and out of the Philippines for war drills. Last year, President Duterte decided to terminate the pact after the U.S. denied a visa to a senator close to him. Now, Washington has welcomed the pact's restoration. Journalist and political commentator Munir Ahmed has said that the restoration of the pact has its roots in U.S. efforts to curtail the economic power of China. He says the new decision would be damaging to peace in Southeast Asia and beyond. Take a listen.
This administration's policy to curtail economic development and economic spread of China. That is totally, basically, curtail China's BRI, Belt and Road Initiative as well. That is, Iran and Pakistan and other countries are part of it. More than 130 or 132 countries in different continents, right from Africa to Central Asia, have signed it. That is the big economic threat to the U.S. administration and allies. They are like making every effort to do whatever could hamper the peace of the region. So the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the troops of U.S. and NATO, that is also one effort to destabilize the peace in the region so that they could hamper CPEC and BRI initiatives in the region.
The United States and Russia are trying to walk back from the brink. The two sides have launched a diplomatic effort to try to resolve some of their most serious disputes.
Ties between the United States and Russia are far worse than strained. The two have been on a confrontational path for a very long time. Tensions have been deteriorating over the past years after a series of tit-for-tat actions that have left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such tit-for-tat actions, like consulate closures or expulsions of diplomats, have made it difficult to even conduct basic bilateral diplomacy. The lack of proper diplomatic contacts between the two rivals has increased the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a potential disaster. Recently, Russia's top diplomat warned that tensions between Washington and Moscow were getting close to a dangerous confrontation. The two sides say they want to prevent any such scenario. This week, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia sat down for talks on strategic stability. The talks in Geneva were arranged in June when U.S. President Joe Biden met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two major nuclear-armed states.
I think that what's happened in the last 20 years under Putin's basic leadership, I think, for the last 20 years, has been a resurgence of Russian power, of Russian technology, of the place of Russia in the world. And as a major country, the United States doesn't like that.
Can the ongoing diplomatic effort help reduce tensions and pave the way for cooperation?
There was no breakthrough during the negotiations in Geneva on Wednesday, but Russian and U.S. delegations will reconvene for further talks in September. The ongoing diplomacy has raised hopes of a reduction in tensions, but the two sides are still engaged in acrimonious exchanges.
The meeting on Wednesday was the first in a series of planned talks aimed at enhancing communication and reduce the possibility of missteps. The delegations were headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. The U.S. side called the discussions professional and substantive. The Russians said they were satisfied with the conclusions and that America showed readiness for constructive dialogue. But despite the positive signs, controversial comments by the U.S. president drew condemnation from Moscow. In an address to national intelligence officers, Joe Biden accused Russia of trying to interfere in the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. He warned that an escalation in cyber attacks could lead to war. Biden also said Russia has nuclear weapons and oil wells and nothing else to earn money from. The U.S. president claimed this economic weakness makes Russia even more unpredictable and dangerous. The Russians were quick to respond. The Kremlin said Biden's statements showed America's erroneous understanding of modern Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow regrets that America is more of an adversary than a partner, despite the Russian government showing political will to normalize ties. Observers believe the latest exchanges further reveal the depth of distrust and deep differences between Washington and Moscow.
Russians have begun to reassert their normal geographic dominance in the area. And in particular, this was true with Ukraine. And, you know, so can you imagine the situation if the Russians had on the Canadian border, you know, an army? We would freak out. Well, the Russians feel the same way about NATO being in the middle of Europe now. And they felt very, very betrayed by the fact that NATO expanded because they felt they had a deal in the 1980s with Gorbachev that wouldn't happen. And so they're upset about that and have been very clear about that.
Problems that have soured bilateral relations are many. And both sides seem unwilling to back down when it comes to strategic issues. The upcoming talks will probably show whether the two sides are serious enough to resolve their problems.
A U.S. watchdog has slammed Washington's, quote, hubris in Afghanistan, warning that the Afghan government could face an existential crisis due to American policies. I discussed this topic further with our guests earlier in our News Review program. A U.S. watchdog has slammed Washington's, quote, hubris in Afghanistan, warning that the Afghan government could face an existential crisis due to American policies. U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, John Sopko, noted that, quote, mendacity was another key factor in Washington's failure to create a more effective Afghan military. He slammed the high-ranking U.S. defense officials and diplomats for lying to themselves and to the public, saying they exaggerated the situation in Afghanistan. He also cited the repeated failure of top officials to learn from their mistakes. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. 20 years later, Washington is leaving Afghanistan, but the country is still unstable and is marred by deadly violence. To discuss this issue a little bit further, I'm going to bring in dear guests for this part of the program. David McBride joins us. He's an Australian whistleblower and former British Army major who joins us via Skype out of Sydney. I also will have the pleasure of hosting Mr. John Bosnich. He's a political analyst who joins us via Skype out of Belgrade. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. I guess I'm going to start in Sydney and get the comments of Mr. David McBride about the recent revelation, or if we can call that so, Mr. McBride, a revelation. It's no secret, actually, the results of what's been happening over the past 20 years if you've been a political observer. What do you think about, this recent development, this recent saying that has been actually said to the public? What do you think about this? What does that tell you?
Well, I'm very pleased to see it. I agree with it entirely, and I think it, more people in America should know it, and some accountability should happen. A lot of very senior people lied about what was going on. We lied to the public. We lied to ourselves. I agree with the Inspector General, and I think some action needs to be taken because they have tarnished the U.S.'s reputation forever, and if they don't take any action to hold people responsible, I don't think the American government's credibility will come.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bosnich, how about you?
Well, I agree with our fellow analyst. This is not a first case. This is just the latest in a series of lying foreign policy moves and actually wars of aggression by the United States. If we were sitting in 1946, we would be asking for the U.S. government officials who authorized this war to be brought to Nuremberg to be tried for war crimes and potentially to be hung. But of course, we live in a world that is not perfect, and we live in a world where the United States government has distinguished itself by refusing to recognize the International Criminal Court. So justice will take time, but justice is coming.
Mr. McBride, I gather you have some your own personal experiences in Afghanistan. I'm very interested in hearing some of those that pertain to the lies that the public is now hearing that have been given by the U.S. authorities over the past 20 years. Please recount some of them for us. Or, you know, in general, what aspect of this do you think has been could be said was mendacity, out of mendacity, could be said was pure lies about Afghanistan and the presence of the mostly Western troops in that country?
I think mendacity is a strong word, but it is accurate in this case, and I'm glad that the Inspector General didn't hold off. He has restored my faith that there are good people in the U.S. government, but mendacity is right. We, for at least 10 years, probably the whole time we were there, each year we put out reports saying we are making slow, steady progress. And next year, we frequently said, the next calendar year, we will see ultimate victory. Now, we said that for 10 years, and nobody said, but you said that last year. Everybody kept repeating this lie. We repeated it to our governments. We repeated it to our populations, and knowing it was a lie. And what's worse, and for a soldier, I found this made me most angry, because we were pretending what we were doing was working, we never changed our tactics. So we kept repeating the same failed strategy over and over again and saying it was winning. We were trying to win the war simply by saying we were winning the war. We knew it was a lie, and he's quite right to say, my fellow columnist, that's a criminal offence, and that's treason. To take a country to war, to kill your own soldiers, knowing that it's all really a political sham, that's treason.
It's, of course, you know, when I hear your experiences, sir, you know, it is very frustrating to be in the field of war and to be given the same line every year, and then on the ground you see no progress, and then the war ends and the U.S. troops want to leave Afghanistan, the country that you once fought in, and you see the Taliban is ever more powerful in that country, Wendell, you know, even more powerful than 2001 when the war started. Mr. Bosnich, don't you think, or do you think there should be some kind of accountability in all this, and for the people to be actually brought to justice, the ones who perpetrated this, the ones who came up with all those false excuses, the ones that, according to this report, have lied. What can be done about them?
Well, there are a number of available options. I can tell you that we've seen this kind of lying in Ukraine. We've seen this kind of lying in Syria. We've seen this kind of lying in the Balkans. We've seen this lying going on literally for decades now. And the primary target of the lying has been the American public, because the American public, regardless of what you might think about their government, which is a duopoly in which the people have very little direct say, the American public are decent, normal people like everybody else around the world. And so the best solution would be for American citizens to launch legal action within their own country against their own government.
I really appreciate your time, sir, as well as Mr. David McBride, Australian whistleblower and former British Army major out of Sydney. I really appreciate your time as well, sir. For final headline story, Japan plans to expand a state of emergency to four more regions as COVID cases spike to records amid Tokyo Olympics. The government has proposed states of emergency in Osaka and three regions near Olympic host Tokyo through August the 31st. It also plans to extend existing states of emergency for Tokyo and Okinawa by the same date. That comes as COVID surges in Japan. On Thursday, new daily cases topped 10,000 for the first time. The authorities blame the surge on highly transmissible Delta variant, denying any link with the Olympics. Delta has also increased infections in the Philippines in recent days. The government now plans a two-week lockdown in the capital, Manila. It will begin on August the 6th.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. The opponents of the Islamic Republic theory, groups hostile to the authority of the people, secular liberals, and religious believers not believing in the people. As for the opponents of the people's authority and democracy, these people too were comprised of two fronts. One front was formed of secular liberals who believed in democracy, but who said that democracy has nothing to do with religion whatsoever. According to that view, it is liberals, technicians, and, as they themselves put it, technocrats, who should get involved in the area of republicanism and democracy. They believe that religious democracy and the Islamic Republic were meaningless, so they did not agree with the republic aspect. And there were another group of people who believed in religion, but who also believed that religious authority did not depend on the people. Who are the people to rule? It is religion which should rule and govern. These were another group. Examples of the latter were witnessed lately in the excessive form of Daesh, who naively thought that they were advocating religious authority, and who did not grant any role to people. The theory of the Islamic Republic complies with the essence of Islam. With reliance on God, with faith in the people, and by benefiting from his deep understanding of religion, Imam stood firm, moving that theory forward and realizing that great accomplishment in society. I should add that this theory is a scholarly outlook which is not based on emotions. That religion should govern and that people should be present in such a government, which could be translated into religious democracy, is something that originates from the heart of Islam. The authority of religion has its origins in the Holy Quran and in Islamic narrations. The Quran has clearly spoken about the authority of religion. If someone denies that, it really shows that they have not deliberated carefully. A holy ayah in Surah An-Nisa says, "We sent not an apostle, but to be obeyed in accordance with the will of Allah." Chapter 4, verse 64. "We sent prophets so that the people obey them." In what things should they obey prophets? What is the subject of this obedience? There are hundreds of Quranic ayahs which explain this obedience.
It is being called the story of the year. An Israeli spying company has been caught selling software to authoritarian regimes that have used it to surveil more than 50,000 people worldwide. That company is NSO, founded in 2010 by former members of Unit 8200, the Israeli military's notorious intelligence squad. Their product is called Pegasus, and it was sold to military, law enforcement, and intelligence agencies in 40 countries, among them some of the world's worst human rights abusing governments. Pegasus is able to attack the cell phones of targeted individuals without them realizing it, monitoring and recording their calls, text, and accessing other information stored on their devices. Dozens of human rights activists, nearly 200 journalists, Several Arab royals and more than 600 politicians are known to have had their communications spied on and compromised. Among those include French President Emmanuel Macron, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, and President of Iraq, Barham Saleh. It gets juicier. Close associates of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi were also attacked and compromised just before his murder by Saudi operatives in 2018, strongly indicating that the information gleaned through Pegasus was crucial in his murder. NSO vehemently denied that their product was used in the assassination. Yet it also put out a statement insisting that it had no access to what its clients did with the software, two seemingly contradicting assertions here. Among those who had their communications and devices spied on by Pegasus were journalists, human rights activists, business executives, academics, and prominent political leaders. The NSO group and its Pegasus software is clearly a major scandal that deserves scrutiny. However, the treatment of the incident by the media has largely absolved the Israeli government of any role in that affair, despite the fact that the NSO group's sales of Pegasus to foreign governments has been approved and defended by Israel's government. This, of course, means that Israel's government has obvious responsibility in the whole scandal as well. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Accusations that spy software known as Pegasus may have been used to carry out surveillance on journalists, activists, and even kings, presidents, and political leaders highlights that surveillance is now for sale. Guess who's selling? Israel. The ability to remotely access phones was once considered something only a few states could do. But high-end espionage and surveillance powers, when in the hands of a rogue entity like Israel, can easily turn into a commercialized weapon that breaches personal privacy in a fraudulent access to personal electronic devices, which would definitely lead to criminal association. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hassan Younis, author, expert in international business management. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Hassan. Now, the Israeli spyware is a breach of personal privacy and a fraudulent access to personal electronic devices. Most alarming is the freedom of expression and freedom of speech here for the journalists, which is basically the foundation of their work. It is being jeopardized by such spyware and malware. Now, the consequences of this is critical, and it might lead to criminal acts, hint the Khashoggi case, for example. Do you think this scandal will finally expose Israel's espionage role all over the world, or maybe just another anti-Semitism card will be played?
Thanks a lot for hosting me, Marwa. It gives me pleasure to be on your show. This spyware has been implemented in a very rude way, and all the documents show that. It leverages cutting-edge technology, unique technology. A lot of research and development was invested in this spyware. Definitely, it's a great violation of human rights, and this is a violation of the Article 19, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Human Rights Law, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. That's why it's being more rude than ever before, especially when you do this kind of espionage. Actually, in business and in politics, we can do kind of due diligence on our opponents, on our rivals. Yet, when it's used in an unethical manner, it becomes espionage. In business, we talk about industrial espionage. In politics, we talk about this kind of crisis. And you start connecting the dots and start linking the information which was leaked from those who were under attack. Literally, it's an attack. Many of the incidents which have come, many of which are which have happened, many of which were criminal incidents. So when you talk about Israel, for example, the nature of business of Israel, the nature of what they do is a criminal. So when you want to develop this multi-billion dollar spyware, then you'll use it on your supply chain, on the activities which you do, whether upstream activities, downstream activities, it depends. But it has to be linked to some kinds of criminal activities, whether through you or through some of your partners in the region, locally, internationally. It depends on the target which you want to achieve.
Well, Dr. Hassan, this fiber was developed with cutting-edge technology, as you just mentioned, which basically requires massive investments, research, and development activity. This requires state interventions, maybe consortium organizations to contribute to this spyware. How much does that mean that the US and the UK government were actually on board from the beginning?
Yeah, actually this spyware leverages the power of the fourth industrial revolution, which is social, mobile, analytics, and the cloud. It requires the cloud computing. It requires giving access to this kind of cloud to do the computing. It requires huge power to do the analytics of big data, in addition to social and mobile, which are the two components of the fourth industrial revolution. This requires major investments, huge investments, which individual companies can't afford, which a consortium by itself can't afford. It requires consortia, probably, and definitely of superpowers. Superpowers, it's not a secret that the US and the UK can be part of this consortium, because they are ally in very strong ties with Israel. They have alliances on several fronts. So when it comes to this technology, which is usually exported from the West to our region, then the US and the UK should have a say and should have an investment in research and development. Not any nation has this access to research and development. It is in the hands of few top powers, where the Silicon Valley is, where the leading softwares are. So definitely the US and the UK have a hand. I don't think it's a secret, so they are, I don't think that they are trying to hide this. It's very apparent to everyone.
Well, the leaks raised several concerns and prompted international bodies to condemn these operations. Now, Lebanon, our country, was not immune from this spyware, where attempts have been made to eavesdrop on about 300 phone numbers in Lebanon by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which reveals the extent of the role of Saudi Arabia in preoccupation, basically, in Lebanon's affairs, despite the fact they keep saying it's none of our business. It specifically culminates in the case of former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, and as his phone was subjected to surveillance by said state. I mean, why would such an Arab regime be spying on their own asset to begin with in a country like Lebanon?
Because we are part of the business of these countries. So when we talk about the Lebanese politics, we have never been the decision makers in Lebanon. We receive the decisions from the superpowers. The superpowers can be the USA, Russia, UK, any superpower at the international level, using some of their tools in the region. These tools can be some of the regimes in the region. And we know the rivalry between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the ex-Prime Minister Saad Hariri. Not a rivalry, we know the state of dislike, if I don't want to exaggerate. They don't want him to be the Prime Minister. It was apparent, otherwise he would have been the elected president. Many people talk about kind of personal conflicts between MBS and Saad Hariri. Mm-hmm. So this might have led to the espionage or the surveillance on his phone, because they want access to his personal data, because he's no more trustworthy. He's not trusted by the regional powers, especially by Saudi Arabia.
That's a very funny way of them showing that they care, by actually tapping into his phone. But it is noteworthy that the two of the relatives of a Saudi journalist, the murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed in Istanbul in 2018, has been included in the leaked list of phone numbers targeted by this spyware by Pegasus. This makes Israel complicit, by the way, with the regime of Mohammed bin Salman and the murder, and makes way for more crimes that occurred because of this software. What options do you think international bodies have to deal with this critical issue? And maybe the best question to ask is, do they have enough power to stop the Israeli exported espionage?
Yeah. Actually, I'm not here to comment on the political aspect of what happened with Khashoggi or with Allah in the UAE or with Mansour or many other names. definitely the judicial bodies and the journalists will do these connection of the dots. And I think when you connect the dots, when you put the different independent variables into the formula, you can come up with some critical conclusions, because this is the story of the year, as Edward Snowden has named it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely it requires and I've read a lot of condemnation, if I can say, by the university, by people saying that it's this is a violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the international human rights law, the laws on civil and political rights. Many journalism associations worldwide have condemned this rude spyware, as I've said, because it's not any spyware. When Israel develops this spyware, uses its relationship with the top industrialized nations in the world, invests a lot in this bleeding-edge technology, not only cutting-edge, it's a bleeding-edge technology, and the nature of the business of Israel has a criminal aspect, then this requires not only condemning it, but going a bit further than that, because it's a violation,
mm-hmm,
of our basic rights of freedom of expression. It's
and
invasion
of
our
basically.
Privacy. Yeah, if my privacy is being invaded, then I will not feel free to express my opinions,
definitely,
whether political or not political.
Definitely.
So.
Such
invasion
a pleasure,
of privacy.
Dr.
Yeah,
Hassan Yunus.
It's my utmost pleasure, actually.
To discuss Pegasus and how it can affect everyone's lives, basically. Dr. Hassan Yunus, author and expert in international business management, thank you very much for your time, for being with us to discuss this. Now, please stay tuned, because we will next be talking about TOCA.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the abuse of Pegasus software has been known for several years, though the latest revelations appear to have gained such traction in the mainstream media owing to the high number of civilians who have reportedly been surveilled through its use. The continuation of the now years-long scandal surrounding the abuse of Pegasus has also brought considerable controversy and notoriety to the Israeli company that developed it, the NSO Group. While the NSO Group has become infamous, other Israeli companies with even deeper ties to Israel's intelligence apparatus have been selling software that not only provides the exact same services to governments, to intelligence agencies, but purports to go even farther than that. Come along, meet TOCA, the most dangerous Israeli spyware firm you've never heard of, in this following report.
Mainstream media's myopic focus on Israel's Pegasus spyware and the threats it poses means that the other companies, like TOCA, go uninvestigated, even when their product presents an even greater potential for abuse and illegal surveillance. Pegasus is merely the tip of the Israeli cyber-spying iceberg. Another piece of software, TOCA, is far more dangerous and outrageous. TOCA markets itself as a one-stop hacking shop for governments that require extra capability to fight terrorists and other threats to national security in the digital domain. The company's software is designed to infiltrate any device connected to the internet, not just smartphones. For the company, this includes devices like Amazon Echo, Google Nest connected home products, as well as connected fridges, thermostats, and alarms. Exploits in these products discovered by TOCA, the company said at the time, would not be disclosed to vendors, meaning those flaws would continue to remain vulnerable to any hacker, whether a client of TOCA or not. TOCA is a product of the Israeli National Security State, having been co-founded by former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and was also designed by members of Unit 8200. This suggests that it is a front for the Israeli government. Toka was launched in 2018 with the explicit purpose of selling a, quote, tailored ecosystem of cyber capabilities and software products for governmental, law enforcement, and security agencies, unquote. Today, Toka's software suite claims to offer its customers in law enforcement, government, and intelligence the ability to obtain targeted intelligence and to conduct forensic investigations as well as covert operations. Toka's target clientele are the same as those of Pegasus, providing an easy opportunity for governments to gain access to even more surveillance capabilities than Pegasus offers, but without risking notoriety in the media, since Toka has long avoided the limelight. The company's activities are concerning in light of the fact that Toka has been directly partnered with Israel's Ministry of Defense and other Israeli intelligence and security agencies since its founding. The company works closely with these government agencies, according to Israel's Minister of Defense website. This collaboration, per Toka, is meant to enhance their products. Toka's direct collaboration with Israel's government is also made clear through its claim that it sells its products and offers its services only to trusted governments, law enforcement agencies, and intelligence agencies. Toka has stated that Russia, China, and, quote, other enemy countries, unquote, would never be customers of the company. In other words, only countries aligned with Israeli policy goals, particularly in occupied Palestine, are permitted to be customers and gain access to its trove of powerful hacking tools. This is consistent with Israel's effort to leverage its high-tech sector as a means of countering the boycott, divest, and sanctions BDS movement globally.
To discuss this very critical issue with us from Los Angeles is Fiorella Isabel, journalist from the Convo Couch. Thank you very much, Fiorella. Toka, the most dangerous Israeli spyware firm that we've never heard of. And thanks to the journalism of, I have to give credit to journalist Whitney Webb for writing extensively about it. How come it is such a major spyware firm that does business at a governmental level, yet you have never heard about it at a global media level?
Right. So the media, the United States media particularly, right, all Western media, but United States media is the most heavily propagandized media. CNN, MSNBC, Fox, they only cover what they're told to. They're basically state stenographers for the security state agencies. You have more MSNBC and CNN hosts that have worked under the CIA and for national intelligence. So it's no surprise, given our strong relationship with Israel, our very, you know, symbiotic relationship with Israel, that this has been completely taken out. Now, we've talked about Pegasus and other NSOs, but the reason this is so Toka is so private is because anything that comes out, whether it's a leak or anything that is promoted by mainstream media, like The Guardian, like every other mainstream media outlet, has to be carefully selected. So they're only going to tell you exactly like how much they're allowed to tell
Fiorella,
you.
According to a profile of that company, which is published by Forbes just shortly after it was launched, Toka advertised itself as a one-stop hacking shop for governments that require extra capability to fight terrorism and other threats to national security in the digital domain. I want to focus about the, quote, threat to national security, unquote, issues. I bet my life that it is only sold to regimes in line with Israel's policy of occupation. How dangerous is that notion where colonial interventionist states are collaborating with Israel for espionage?
It's extremely dangerous because if you go back to 2012, companies in the tech surveillance sector of Israel were essentially conducting investigations. And these investigations were also previously conducted by groups like Mossad. So in essence, these companies have been working for Israeli intelligence, but more have popped up since this time. And Cyber Reason is one of these companies. I can get into that later a little bit about how they have pretty much managed themselves into U.S. national intelligence regarding January 6th, but also they have a two-pronged approach regarding Israel. Israel wants to use these tech companies to stop any sort of counter-protest or any sort of appeal to Palestinian solidarity movements, the BDS movement, but they also want to conduct classified intelligence and defense operations through these companies, even though they operate publicly as private companies. And we know that the connection to the World Bank is essential. It was found to be involved in Israeli interests, and Haaretz themselves, which is the go-to news to in Israel, showed us that Netanyahu set up an international committee to realize the potential of international development to strengthen, and I quote, the Israeli economy, improve Israel's political standing, and strengthen its international role. But they also admitted this was not philanthropic. So, like I said, we've seen the partnership between the World Bank and these fund projects also working in governments in Chile and Nigeria, two governments who particularly happen to be very, very pro-Palestinian and pro-BDS movement. Chile had a Palestinian caucus. It has the largest Palestinian community outside the Middle East, perhaps in the Americas. And so you see that this is no coincidence, the relationships that the intelligence of Israel and the United States is trying to insert itself
Fiorella, given that the NSO's Pegasus targets only smartphone Talka, this hacking suit is classified as a lawful intercept product, which means it is capable of targeting any device that is connected to the internet, included but not limited to the smartphone. Now, tell me here if I'm being a bit paranoid, but for example, if an oven is connected to the internet or if a car is connected to the internet, you might just well die because of a spyware, wouldn't you?
Right. Talka can get into any device. That's the thing that nobody is talking about, that unlike the others that are specifically a lot, just limited to telephones, Talka can get into anything. Recently, there were accusations, in fact, from high-ranking military officials that in America, these Stingray devices were set up all over the White House. And, of course, we know the Trump administration and the Biden administration's relationship to Israel, and we've seen how much power, right, that the U.S. government gives to Israel, and in its form of billions and billions of dollars per year. We just saw Joe Biden give a billion to Israel when people in the United States are absolutely in need of any aid. But of course, we give this money to Israel in terms of propaganda, in terms of military weapons, and then of course aid them in terms of propaganda via AIPAC. And so, apart from these foreign governments, Talka and other, and other tech surveillance like that can also be used on regular people. We know that the domestic violent extremist categorization now works on anyone with a political opinion, and that's a huge part of where this intelligence is going.
Very, very dangerous indeed. But something very interesting to end off our segment with is the investors of Talka, namely Amdocs and Comverse Infosys. They both were courted scandal in the late 90s, early 2000s for their role in a massive Israeli government espionage operation that targeted U.S. federal agencies during that period. Bottom line, Israel spied on the U.S., and it most probably still does spy on the U.S. How come this is not breaking news in the U.S. media?
Yeah, I mean, again, I go to the fact that the United States media is extremely, extremely pro-Israel, extremely, extremely pro-West. They will not propagandize this. And even independent media won't touch this. I mean, the vast majority of media focuses on electoral politics. They really don't cover the national security state. And in terms of covering this, you are, cast as a right-winger, as being anti-Semitic for simply criticizing the very, very incestuous relationship between the United States and Israel. And, we know that the NSA has expanded surveillance, right? Because recently, commentator Tucker Carlson, who is on the right, accused the NSA of spying on him, and he was ridiculed and gaslighted, even though we know from Snowden and WikiLeaks that the NSA absolutely does spy on Americans, and they have used the DHS to continue doing that via social media accounts. I mentioned the domestic violent extremists and how now they're categorizing anybody that is movement-led, meaning if you're pro-BDS, if you're pro-Palestinian, if you're anti-government, you are a domestic violent extremist, and they will be looking at your social media. So this is a potentially very dangerous and authoritarian situation we're in, not just for obviously for the world and foreign policy-wise, what these actors could do, but also for Americans and journalists who want to expose these companies.
Bye-bye freedom of speech and freedom of expression. I want to thank you very much. From Los Angeles, Fiorella Isabel, journalist from the Convo Couch, for waking up really early to be with us. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality. Back to
Reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Back to Reality with me, Muhammad Javad, and my two guests. Let me ask them actually to introduce themselves first.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, and I'm glad to be here with you guys.
Thank you very much. And sister?
I'm Radia Shamili, at your service.
Well, the first topic that we were given by the producer to talk about is something quite interesting. The question might be phrased or rephrased like this. What happens after adding Muslim before a couple of words? Like, for example, when you talk about a Muslim child or Muslim children, what do we mean by that? Is it appropriate to add such, let's say, a title, a prefix, or whatever? Sister, let me start with you.
If you are talking in a Muslim country and then you're saying Muslim child, or if you're talking in a non-Muslim Islamophobic society, or if you're talking a Western Muslim-friendly society or a Western Muslim-friendly neighborhood. So it really changes the answer to your question. So if I am taking two viewpoints into consideration. The first one is when you have a non-Muslim Islamophobic point of view in your consideration, that's when fear comes about. That's when extremism, that's when oppression of women, forced hijab comes into consideration, or backwarded countries come into consideration, or halal food. All these labels come in to...
The stereotypes.
Yeah, to attach to a Muslim doctor, Muslim child, Muslim woman, whatever. On the other hand, if you're still living in an Islamophobic society, and from the view of a Muslim, considering that this fellow that is here is a Muslim child or a Muslim woman, it creates a kind of unity. It creates a kind of friendship. You know, because you know that there are shared of point of views. You know, all of you eat halal food. There are so much in common between you and that fellow over there, which is called a Muslim. For example, if you go to a hospital and you're a hijabi woman and you know that the guy there is a Muslim doctor, then you know that, like, you have certain restrictions or certain limitations that you don't want the doctor. You would prefer female doctor. And then that guy, that Muslim doctor, would definitely understand you.
You mean you get a positive vibe, right?
Exactly.
In that kind
when
of
you
society,
say Muslim,
in that
whatever.
Kind of context.
Exactly.
Sayyid Abdullah, what do you think of these titles added to the beginning of words and concepts?
Well, I'll tell you what happens when you add a title like that. But before I tell you this, but you would only use that title as a Muslim before anything else is if you were in a foreign country, like in a Western country. where they use that title for a few reasons. One, if they want to identify you,
uh-huh.
right? So if they want to separate you from the crowd,
yes.
and they want to point a finger at you, it's like, that's a Muslim kid. For example.
So you mean it's all negative?
Well, obviously it's negative, because in a Muslim country, whenever you say this is a Muslim guy,
uh-huh.
do we say that? Oh, this is a Shia
no.
guy. No, we don't say
as
that.
Long so as they pronounce the West Muslim.
We actually do say, like, if you're like in Isfahan and you're in the Armenian neighborhood, then you say, like, this is an Armenian guy, this is a Muslim guy. So you do use it in, like,
yeah,
like in Lebanon, you do use it. Even in Muslim countries, there are a lot of, like there's controversial, like, different kinds of diversities of religion.
Yeah.
So you do use that.
Exactly. So if I'm saying a Muslim country, I didn't say, like, a country that's got a mixture of races. So if you live in an area which has few races or few religions, obviously you would use this word, right? But I'm talking about, you know, like in a Muslim country, usually we don't use it if everyone is a Muslim. So you'd use it in a place where there are differences. Considering the fact that I spent all my life in Australia, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? In a school, when we do something wrong with the Muslim kids, right? They say the Muslim guy done it, right?
Seriously? Is that their approach in Australia? Like the Muslim guy
well,
did
I mean,
it?
I don't want to generalize. So they say Muslims. Or now, because, you know, they were under a lot of heat, the media, because of
mm-hmm.
using the Muslim word, and they start saying Arab, right?
Uh-huh.
Or an Arabic background. And then when they went under a lot of heat, they said an Iraqi guy or a Lebanese guy, for example. So they would always use that something to name you with, to identify you with. So the minute they say a Muslim guy.
I don't think it's limited only one country or two. You know, most countries, wherever you go, when there is a kind of, like, minority, whatever minority it might be, like religious minority, racial minority,
it's not a matter of minorities, because, for example, if I speak from my experience, right, as an Australian, we have many minorities. We have, for example, Buddhists, we have atheists, we have, I don't know, all religions, right, Sikh. And Sikh wear turban, mind
yes.
you, in Australia.
True.
And,
they look like very,
very
much
strict,
like,
to it. But
yeah.
you don't see anyone saying, oh, that Sikh guy, or that Sikh doctor, or that Sikh this.
Yes.
I do. I would say that Sikh doctor.
Well, we would.
I would.
Yeah.
Yeah. But see, they, in the back of their heads, even if they want to say it, right, they'd be more cautious. Like, oh,
yeah.
maybe I shouldn't
True.
Say it. I don't want to hurt his feeling.
Yeah.
But when it comes to a Muslim, they shoot at you straight away, right? So either they want to identify you
uh-huh.
as a Muslim person, or either they just want to defame Islam. Right, so they attach anything that you do wrong to Islam. So when you say a Muslim guy or a Muslim youth, obviously they use it in a negative notion. But we as Muslims, like the sister said, we use that term as well as Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For example, if I want to suggest a doctor to my friend, right, I say he's a Muslim doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gives him a bit of comfort. If I want to say, okay, a group of Muslim youth, it gives them a bit of comfort, and
yes.
so on and so forth. So we use it in a positive way.
Yes.
Other people use it in a negative way. But it's, nevertheless, it's something that I would, like the sister said, it depends on how you look at it. Like, it depends on who you are, who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so.
Before we go on and continue our discussion, let's take a short break and we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We are still with Sayyid Abdullah and Sister Razia Shamli. And the topic we are talking about is adding the title Muslim before names. All right. Sister Razia, you were talking about the positive aspect, especially in those areas where the Muslim communities were dominant, right?
Yeah.
And this kind of ideology or shared common beliefs is something that gives it a positive atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you hear the word or you see the word, read the word Muslim before names, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate on it a bit?
It's not necessarily where the majority of population is Muslim, but I'm saying that yes, there's a lot of negative image about Islam going on in the West and in non-Muslim countries. But I think we as Muslims who are living in non-Muslim countries can change the outlook of the people who are living with us, like our colleagues, schoolmates, mm-hmm. friends, neighbors.
Yes.
And I quite clearly remember the experience that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, had in Paris, where it was Christmas time and he distributed